Okay, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you. So again, Charlotte Taylor, on behalf of appellant. I'd like to focus on the private right of action and ERISA standing questions. On the private right of action, the No Surprises Act provides that IDR determinations, quote, shall be binding upon the parties involved, unquote, and that resulting payments by insurers to providers, quote, shall be made directly to the non-participating provider or facility, not later than 30 days after the date on which such determination is made. This language conveys an unmistakable intent on the part of Congress to create both a private right and a private remedy. Language closely similar to the shall pay mandate in the No Surprises Act has repeatedly been found by the Supreme Court, this court, and others to create a private right to payment, as indeed the district court held. But the statute also creates a private remedy. When Congress used the word binding, it deliberately used a term that, in the world of arbitration, is synonymous with enforceable in court. That makes sense in this statutory context. Congress has taken away providers' right to payment from patients and channeled them into mandatory IDR with insurers. The scheme would be pointless if the awards were not enforceable. HCSC asks this court to hold that where it owes money to a provider after a valid IDR process, it can simply ignore that obligation to pay and wait and see if the government comes after it. That is contrary to the plain statutory text as well as basic fairness. On ERISA standing, as this court held in Denning, relying on its North Cyprus case, a breach of contract is a sufficient injury for standing purposes. Where an insurer fails to pay for care as required by the terms of an ERISA plan, it breaches that contract and the beneficiary has standing to sue, regardless of whether the beneficiary suffers a pocketbook injury. The providers step into the shoes of the beneficiary and have standing to pursue their ERISA claim. The district court rejected this straightforward conclusion, but all applicable authority supports the providers here.
Counsel, in your view, is it necessary for this panel to both opine on the private right and remedy part and on the ERISA part, or are they alternatives?
It is necessary to reach both questions.
Okay, why is that?
So ERISA claims are only a subsection of the overall claims. Also, the providers are not able to pursue an ERISA claim unless they obtain a written assignment from the plan beneficiary, and they don't obtain those in every single case.
But if we agreed with you on the private right of action, wouldn't that take care of any the subset of ERISA plans?
So we still think that they're distinct because ERISA is, again, it's vindicating an interest of the plan beneficiary, and there are some remedies that are available in ERISA actions that may be distinct from...
It's a different remedies, perhaps.
Yes. Okay. But again, certainly reaching the private right of action and holding that there is the ability to come to court would allow providers in all cases, whether it's an ERISA plan or not, to come to court and get payment where an insurer is not paying an award. Just to start with the shall pay language, this, I think should be uncontroversial that it creates a private right. The district court agreed. We can look at this court's decision in Legacy Community Health as a recent example holding that type of shall pay language creates a right. But it also implies a remedy. As eight members of the Supreme Court agreed in the Maine Community Health case in 2020, money mandating language such as shall pay indicates a congressional intent to confer both a right to payment and a damages remedy for a defaulted amount. Justice Scalia had a series of opinions that we cite, for example, the Keytronic, just saying if a statute says A is liable to B, that means that there's a cause of action to proceed against A in court. But Congress didn't stop with the shall pay language. It also used the term binding to describe the effect of these IDR awards. And it has long been established that where parties agree to binding arbitration, they are agreeing that any award can be enforced in court. That is set forth with helpful historical context in the Fourth Circuit and Judge Niemeyer's opinion in this Fairdrop case. You can also look at the Fourth Circuit's decision in Corvus. I don't think it was in Niemeyer was Corvus, and just to clarify that. And in the 11th Circuit's decision in Booth, in this court's decision in Place St. Charles, these are all cases that recognize, even though the FAA actually requires that the written agreement provide that it be enforceable in court, courts have not even, have not faulted parties for not using those magic words. They've said if you agree to binding arbitration, you are effectively agreeing that this can be enforced in court.
Here, the statute sort of takes the place of the binding agreement.
Pardon?
The statute kind of takes the place of an agreement to arbitrate.
Is that right, because we don't have a written agreement to arbitrate. We're channeled by federal law into these proceedings. And so if the statute had not used the word binding, then I think, you know, because there's no written agreement to enforceability, that may have been an issue. So Congress solved that problem by using the word binding in the statute and making clear that these are enforceable. So the only, I wanted to touch on their, I think their main argument that that we shouldn't read that language to mean what it says, which is that there's agency enforcement that either, you know, overcomes the binding language or otherwise displaces what appears to us to be a plain remedy. They have not identified anything that comes close to the type of comprehensive enforcement authority that this court held, for example, in Stokes, would indicate that Congress didn't intend a remedy. They point to a single provision that actually only allows HHS, and I know the government is here and they will speak to the enforcement authority, but that only allows HHS to enforce with respect to individual plans and non-federal governmental plans, so state and municipal plans. That's, again, a small, because ERISA plans are such a significant part of this universe, that's only a small slice. That's not sort of comprehensive oversight authority. If you compare that to Stokes, for example, there the Department of Transportation was expressly given the authority to administer the anti-discrimination provisions there. It also provided that individuals who believed they'd suffered discrimination could file a complaint with DOT, and it was mandatory that DOT investigate and follow up, and then further remedies followed from there. Here, there's at best a patchwork. Even putting together provision that they cite with ERISA, that doesn't get you all of the types of health plans that are out there and all of the types of enforcement.
So what do you make of the language, shall not be subject to review?
So as I laid out previously, we don't think that judicial review is the same type of enterprise as enforcement. You can have a binding award. Again, you can have a binding district court judgment that may never be reviewed, but is still binding on the parties. And so, you know, the text is very clear. This is that, you know, if it means anything, it means that a party that has a valid IDR award it is binding. They can come to court and enforce it, and their adversary would be able to raise as a defense the types of misrepresentations that the statutory language calls for. That's a totally separate, conceptually separate question from when an award that is binding can be subject to judicial review in the federal courts.
Let me ask you whether Guardian Flight and MedTrans, did they attempt to enforce the IDR award for civil penalties through the Department of Health and Human Services? Did they make that?
That's not in the record, but
before suing, mad or after suing, or what?
Pardon?
Before they filed suit, or?
They certainly sought payment. Again, this is beyond the four corners of the complaint, but I'm not aware of whether they, you know, particularly, you know, filed specific, like use the online portal. But again, that online portal, I think the appellees really overstate the significance of it. In the 2023 GAO report, for example, there's at least anecdotal evidence that some providers were told to stop filing complaints with the online, with the help desk, because it was overtaxed. And again, that is not sort of, if you compare that to, for example, Stokes, or you could compare it to sea clamors or any of the other Supreme Court decisions where a comprehensive remedial scheme has been held to either overcome a 1983 cause of action or a private right of action. In all of those cases, there's an explicit remedial authority given to a particular federal agency. In Sea Clamors, there was actually a private right of action. It was just more limited than what the plaintiffs wanted. And you have an agency that is compelled by statute to investigate and follow up in Stokes, right? It didn't have a discretionary duty to just take it or leave it if it received complaints. Here, there's a sort of, you know, the ability to, there's a lot of these IDRs, the ability to file a complaint, and there's no mandatory obligation that you hear back, that it be followed up on. That's a far cry from being able to from the type of enforcement authority that I think HCSC would like it to be. And I also, just to take a step back, this is, I think it's a very unusual federal statute. We think it's basically unprecedented, where the federal government is mandating that parties proceed to arbitration. So this is different from sort of, you know, you have a private claim, you have a claim that you could enforce in common law, now you have to go to arbitration. And I think the question of whether Congress intended to create a private right of action looks different here than where Congress says, you know, you can't pollute waterways or you can't discriminate. There's actually, you know, there's a right to payment. The primary conduct that we're trying to encourage here by allowing a private right of action is payment of an award. And it's more natural to assume, and this is what Maine Community Health and the Keytronic dissent, Justice Scalia's dissent, are getting at, is where the, you know, if you have a binding award that says A shall pay B, it just makes sense that B gets to go to court and ask A to pay if they're delinquent. Having to go, even assuming that the sort of, you know, administrative complaint process that they've identified, you know, covered, you know, was sort of, you know, a possible avenue to enforcement, there's a far cry from saying, well, I've won my court case, and now I get to go use judgment execution remedies to get the damages award from my adversary, versus I won my court case and I really hope that the federal government will go find the defendant and threaten them with civil penalties if they don't pay. That's just not how we think about enforcement or what we think makes something binding.
All right, thank you.
I can reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yeah, you saved time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Soder?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Kevin Soder from the Department of Justice for the government. I'd like to begin by addressing the cause of action under the No Surprises Act and then turn briefly to standing under ERISA. On the No Surprises Act, as my colleague explained, the text and structure of the statute make clear that the parties to an IDR proceeding may seek judicial enforcement of the resulting award. Of course, the other side focuses on the enforcement possibilities by the government, and I'd like to address those arguments directly. I think there are several reasons why the authority that they point to is not an adequate alternative means to ensure that these awards remain binding. First is that there is piecemeal jurisdiction as to who can enforce any complaint under this process. The defendant cites to Section 300GG-22. If you look at the very beginning of that statute, it makes clear that even for complaints that would otherwise be within HHS's jurisdiction, the states are the primary enforcers of that. It specifies that HHS may only step in if it's determined, quote, that a state has failed to substantially enforce a provision. And then it repeats that language in subsection B, which addresses the secretary's enforcement ability. Additionally, as my colleague pointed out, there are going to be many circumstances where the Department of Labor would be the sole authority to pursue, or at least there's some sort of shared jurisdiction between Labor and Treasury that does not involve HHS. So you'd be talking about dividing this up not only to the states versus HHS, but also within federal government agencies. And that's, of course, just one piece of why this isn't adequate to overcome all of the textual evidence. Additionally, it's indirect. HHS can't take the monetary penalties and transfer them over to the provider who is entitled to payment under this scheme. It would not be comprehensive, even as to the subset that HHS or Labor could seek enforcement of, because of resource constraints and enforcement discretion. There are many steps that would have to be gone through before you could even get a civil monetary penalty under the scheme that's cited by HCSC. And in fact, actually, this scheme has not ever led to a request by HHS for civil monetary penalties under the No Surprises Act. That would be unprecedented here. And then finally, I would just note that if you're looking to what Congress intended when it enacted the No Surprises Act specifically, this section 300GD-22 is a pre-existing statutory authority over the general area that's covered by this part of the statute. It was enacted in 1996 as part of HIPAA. And so if you are looking to displace all of the clear textual indications in the No Surprises Act itself, this is just not a very useful place to look. I'm happy to address any questions the court has about the No Surprises Act cause of action or this enforcement issue. On the sort of core points, I think my colleague covered most of them. There are these numerous Justice Scalia opinions that we cited in our brief as well, including in Keytronic, where he says, to say that A is liable to B is the express creation of a right of action. And that is quite similar to what we have here. Turning to ERISA standing, the core issue is whether a plan beneficiary suffers cognizable Article III harm when the plan fails to accord the benefit that's required under the contractual terms as amended in effect by ERISA and the No Surprises Act. And there, I think this court's decision in North Cyprus Medical Center is quite clear that a plan's failure to fulfill its contractual obligations is all that is required to demonstrate Article III standing. Justice Thomas's concurrence in Spokeo made clear that you look to historically grounded rights that can be enforced in court, and the contract is one of those rights. And just stepping back, the idea that that the patient here is deprived of the benefit of their bargain is sort of core to this. We're talking about a patient who has a health plan that specifies that it must cover certain emergency and air ambulance services under the terms of the ERISA and the No Surprises Act. And if there were no cause of action under ERISA, or no standing under ERISA, we'd be talking about a situation where the health plan could completely fail to live up to its obligation to make any payment to the provider, and yet that is the benefit that the patient has contracted for. I'm happy to address any questions the court may have.
Thank you, Mr. Soder, and we appreciate your participation as amicus.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Cardoza?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ray Cardoso representing the appellees in this matter. In determining whether Congress expressed an intent to authorize this private cause of action, Justice Scalia's opinion in Sandoval instructs us we need to look for an expression of intent in the statute, not just to create the right, but to create a court remedy. And the thing that stands out about this statute is the only provision that refers to going to court at all in this lengthy statute begins by being expressly as broadly restrictive on the right to review as you can word a statute. There shall not be judicial review. And then it goes on to explicitly state the category of cases in which you can go to court. It uses the word except, and it says except cases described in paragraphs 1-4 of section 10 of the FAA. No one's argued at any point, and there's no dispute, this case is not one described in paragraphs 1-4.
I think this goes back to something I was asking about in the first argument, which is, the language in subsection 2, that's a powerful argument. However, if I read it the way that you are advocating right now, what happens to subsection 1? Have we not blue penciled it out of the statute?
No, not at all, because—
Okay, what function does it serve then?
Binding, again, just giving binding the plain meaning English definition, which doesn't incorporate or add the concepts of enforcement or judgment. Binding means it's not an advisory opinion, it has legal effect. So, and it's interesting that it appears—
Yeah, but where is the legal effect if one can't go to court and sue it and say, look, I should get my award?
Well, you just heard my opponents speculate that if they go to the agency, which they never did, the non-answer to that question, I want to be clear, they never went to the agency, they sued right away. If they go to the agency looks, and this determination has the force of law. It is binding. The agency is supposed to enforce it. That's meaning here. And it's interesting, and that meaning also fits for, it's very interesting when you look at this clause, What is the heading under which it appears? It's called effects of determination. So what is the effect? One effect is it's binding, it's not advisory. The second effect is you can't go to court. Those are side by side. So when you read effects of determination binding and not—
Well, is it, if I get an award in an arbitration and the person who's been ordered to pay something just refuses, and I go to court and I sue, is that really judicial review of the award, or is it enforcement of the award?
It's judicial review, Your Honor, and we've cited on pages 28 through 29 of our brief 5 cases and 3 statutes that use judicial review to refer to enforcement. That's how it's always been used. And I'd also, this is the one thing that they cannot explain. Contrast this statute with the most analogous, the closest statute Congress has passed, the Administrative Dispute Resolution Act, 5 U.S.C. Section 580C. And listen to this language. A final award is binding on the parties to the arbitration proceeding. So we've got the exact same word there, binding. And may be enforced pursuant to Section 9 through 13 of the FAA. So when Congress wants to add that enforcement authority under the FAA in the closest analogous statute, they did it explicitly. And look at what they did in this case. There's no "and may be enforced." There is instead the exact opposite, no judicial review whatsoever, except in a cases. They've never really answered this statutory text or the contrast to the most closely analogous language of Congress intents. They can't get past the plain language here because it's well-settled rule of construction. The first thing you do is you look at the text and give it its plain meaning. They lose under that. The second thing you do is look at what Congress has done in most closely analogous. And when they've used different text, that's game over.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. Go ahead.
But I want to add another—
Judge Clement has a question.
Sorry, Judge Clement.
The award is enforceable. Why didn't your client pay the IDR? Why didn't it pay what the IDR entity advised that should be paid?
They did pay it. It's just it came out. It was a processing error, one left hand, right hand. The thing got sent to one plan manages it, another's financially responsible. It ends up getting paid. But this illustrates exactly why Congress limited the review. The payment came after day 30, and these very aggressive providers jump the gun and they want to go to federal court right away. They don't go to the agency, they don't do anything, they don't wait. Their version would transform this statute. But everything Congress did was trying to get these cases out of court. And now if we've got a minor dispute out of timing, the courts are going to be flooded with thousands of these with the aggressive attitude that they employ. But look instead, so you've got the text that's very clear, but then look ahead at the whole statutory scheme. Although they diminish this administrative enforcement possibility, it's very interesting. This is an unusual statute, how much Congress involved the agency. As my learned friend said in the first argument this morning, I think her exact words were, this statute is very unique because everything happens under, her words, auspices of a federal agency. The agencies involved in the setting up the IDR process, certifying it. Congress also said, we want you to report on how this is working, including non-compliance with the terms by either side, providers or plans. Everything about this statute reads as if Congress says, this is our first step into the foray, and we're moving slowly with restraint. We're not creating a federal court of action. But you, the secretary, are going to report to us on how well it is going. And if we really have a problem, if the administrative agency can't handle this enforcement, then Congress will take up whether to create a court action. But that is something that fits the entire text of the statute, that explains all the reporting, the heavy involvement of the agency in all of this. But that brings me back to where I started with Justice Scalia's words. These policy arguments that are being made to you should be directed to Congress, particularly when you've got the indications of a statute that says, this is our first crack at it. Judge Smith, you asked this morning, this is a new statute. How do we interpret it? I would say go cautiously and just follow its plain words. And I want to contrast what's very different about this statute from the cases they've relied on. That extensive agency involvement in all parts, that separates statutes where you can infer Congress wanted the courts involved because they didn't contemplate a role for the agency. They clearly contemplated a very heavy role for the agency, so it's not much to say that this binding obligation can get enforced there. They omitted the most important part of the Maine Community Supreme Court opinion. The only issue was whether the statute created a mandatory obligation on the federal government, because once you find that, the Tucker Act permits you to sue in federal court, the Court of Federal Claims, to enforce a mandatory obligation. That's the missing ingredient here. They don't have that extra statutory act, what Justice Scalia said you must have, not just the right, but something in the statute that gives you the remedy.
Don't you need the Tucker Act to get over sovereign immunity?
Right, but by saying—
Your sovereign immunity is not an issue.
Right, but you also need the Tucker Act creates jurisdiction in the Court of Federal Claims to hear obligations of the government. So if Congress has both created a mandatory obligation and created jurisdiction in federal court, it's a very tiny leap to say they're authorizing.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying is that what Congress intended here is not for court enforcement, but rather agency enforcement. I think your argument boils down to that, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the United States said that in some cases, it's going to be the states who are the primary enforcer. So what is your response to that?
That's because there's some provisions in this act that confer a role for the states, but not in the kind of case we have here. There's no role for the state. These are the IDR process that's squarely a right that's created solely federally, which is another important point that they're overlooking. They're saying this is just a private dispute. It's bizarre that we have to go through all this. It's not a private dispute. The only right they're invoking is a federal act. There's no contract between our client and them. Congress created this to relieve the patients from the obligation, and the way they did it is said, by statute alone, the plan has to step in and bear a responsibility.
Well, before the statute was passed, the providers could go against the patient, right?
No, yeah, they'd go against the patient. So
they can't do that anymore, right?
They can't do that anymore. So
the statute took that away.
The statute took that away, but it.
Sure. Okay.
But the point is, there was never before, and there's never after a private right against the plan. The only right against the plan is created by the statute, so it's subject to the limitations in that statute,
okay,
including no review. And that brings me to another crucial point that came up in the argument this morning. This analogy to contractual arbitration does not work because you don't have the crucial element in this statutory regime of consent. As this court knows, all of arbitration law is founded on contract principles and principles of consent. So you can infer from consent to arbitration a consent to federal court. But when you have a statute that makes you go through this IDR process and you don't have the foundational contractual element of consent, the inference of a right to enforcement just doesn't follow. Again, we come back to Justice Scalia's words. You have to have that expressed in the statute, and you do not here. If I could turn to the ERISA point, the argument on ERISA completely overlooks the controlling Supreme Court on-point precedent of Thole versus U.S. Bank, which says an ERISA plan beneficiary cannot have standing unless they suffer a financial injury. The assertion that there's a violation of the statute or a violation of the contract does not suffice. And that is actually consistent. They rely on this court's precedent in the North Cyprus case. And again, they're missing the crucial function and way the statute works. In North Cyprus, where it wasn't a right created by statute against the plan, it wasn't non-contracted service, it was a right under the health plan. What this court said was, at the time of the assignment, plan beneficiaries had the legal right to seek payment directly from the plans for charges by non-network healthcare providers. The plan beneficiaries had the right to seek the payment from the plan, so when they assigned it, so too did the providers. That is unambiguously not true under the No Surprises Act. It takes the patients out of it completely. The patients never had a right to go against the plan. The contracts didn't give them that right. The statute uniquely filled in this gap by creating a right between providers and plans. So you cannot possibly get there under ERISA plan assignment theory, and they've never meaningfully addressed the controlling U.S. Supreme Court Thole decision, which came several years after this North Cyprus, and eliminated this notion that an abstract theory or injury can give you standing. But also to answer the question about whether you need to reach the ERISA, I think if you hold there's no private right of action, that disposes of the ERISA claim too. The last thing I want to point out, and it came up in the argument in the first case this morning. So we've talked about the text, we've talked about the structure of the act, and then we've talked about the extensive agency involvement. But another clearly expressed intent in this act, Congress was hopeful or ambitious that these problems would not be litigated. The first thing they require is voluntary negotiations. And as my friend pointed out this morning's argument, they made it difficult to go through this process so people will just work it out and resolve. And creating a federal court cause of action, that's going to undermine that intent, because you're going to have what you had in this case. I'll go all the way to I'm not going to agree at negotiations. Congress wanted it to end at the negotiations. They didn't want it to go to IDR. But they put a little teeth into the IDR. Remember, whoever loses under IDR has to pay the cost of the IDR entity. That's an incentive to agree and not go to IDR in the first place. But then we're just not going to negotiate unless the other side gives us what we want, which is not an attitude that gets agreement. We're going to take it to the finish line at IDR. If it doesn't turn out the way we want, we're going to federal court, or it's so on. So they're extending a process that Congress wanted to end earlier. It's another way that's at odds with the statute. So, of course, the analysis begins and ends with the statute and not with any of these policy arguments. But their arguments that this undermines the purpose of the statute are flatly wrong. Denial of the cause of action furthers the purpose of the statute. Unless the court has any questions, I'll prepare to submit. Right,
thank you, Mr. Cardoza. Ms. Taylor, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I wanted to address the argument that Congress should have incorporated more of the FAA by expressly, if it intended to treat these as binding awards. If you look at the text of the FAA throughout, it refers to written agreements to arbitrate, and the existence of such a written agreement is the predicate for many of the remedies that are there. That includes, for example, subsection 10B, subsection 4, or section 10B, section 4. So it wouldn't have made sense or been precise to just incorporate the entire FAA. That would have led to questions about what do we do with this language referring to written agreements. So Congress more efficiently and precisely used the term binding to make these arbitration-like awards binding in court. wanted to clarify, before the NSA, we had a direct right to recover from the patient. We also had, under certain state common law causes of action, the ability to recover from insurers, and all of that has been, taken away by the No Surprises Act. On the policy argument about a floodgates concern, I can assure you that we don't want to sue. We would prefer to simply get paid in a timely manner. And as the AHA and Provider Alliance brief points out, though, failure to pay is a chronic problem. If this court holds, as long as we're talking about policy, that these awards are not enforceable in court, then I don't foresee the failure to pay problem getting any better. If we want to have prompt payment and an incentive to settle, I think it also, on both sides, an incentive to settle, then I think we need to have an enforceable award, as in fact the plain text of the statute does provide for. Finally, I just wanted to address the Thole case that they referred to with respect to the ERISA standing. Thole expressly holds right at the outset that if a beneficiary has not received vested benefits, she has Article III standing to sue under the same provision that we're invoking here. That's Section 502A1B of ERISA that allows participants to recover benefits or enforce rights under the terms of the plan. It then goes on to hold that the participants didn't have an equitable interest in the plan or other property interest that would have justified the other forms of relief that they were seeking. Here, the plan participants have a entitlement to paid for health care, and HCSC and other insurers are simply not following through on their end of the bargain. Under Justice Thomas's Boccaia concurrence, and indeed the TransUnion case, it's been traditionally a cognizable injury under the common law that if you bargain for a right under a contract and your counterparty simply fails to perform that right, there may be questions about remedies and so forth if you can't show a pocketbook injury, but it doesn't defeat your standing to come to court and sue on that breach of contract. That is a core common law cognizable injury.
All right, thank you, Ms. Taylor. Both of your cases are under submission.
Thank you very much.
The court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.